in all of time, in all of history, man has never created one single living cell. Yet your body does that millions to billions of times a day. That's where I put my faith. So I try to encourage people. I want them to know that, listen, that there's a doctor 24/7 on the clock, making chemicals, making hormones, detoxing you. So yeah, compared to the smartest person you know or the greatest doctor you think, I'm just saying that level of intelligence is laughable compared to the wisdom that is in you right now, animating you so you can even hear me say this. If I can help you understand the magnificence of the body that God gave you, your fear of disease drops significantly. Your fear of a fever drops significantly because you realize that you're designed to heal. So I'm Dr. Ben Rall. Welcome to Designed to Heal. Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's episode of Designed to Heal. We have a very special guest who you are going to love. Amazing background, just really an amazing life. I would say a lot of wisdom. And so one of the great things about having a podcast is you kind of get to decide who you have on. And so I feel honored to be able to do that. But I really like introducing amazing people to you, the listeners. And so today we have one of those guests with us. We have today with us Brent Hamacek. And many of you may know him, but many of you probably know him, but you don't know that you know him. What I mean is he's done work and worked with many people, especially in these last years. That's how I became aware of him, with his what happened during COVID and what's happening just in this nation specifically, and medical freedom and these types of things. And so I'm just really excited to have Brent with us today on the show. So welcome to the show.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. I'm always kind of amazed when somebody asks me to be on their show. I'm always figuring they have me confused with somebody else. But since I'm here, we might as well talk. And if I'm a mistake, I'll try to be a good one.
That's funny. If it is the wrong guy, we'll just won't air the episode. Okay. So if we find out you're the wrong guy,
perfect.
Will you give us a little bit of your history, a little bit of your background? It's interesting. It's an interesting one. So I think our listeners will be intrigued. So just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, sure. So the short form on what's been a wonderful journey for me here in my golden years. I'm a Northern Michigan kid, grew up in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan on the Canadian border, studied economics and finance in school, spent 15 years working in the banking industry in a variety of roles until I actually went to work for a living, left the banking industry 25 years ago, and started my own business consulting practice. And that's been quite a ride, over 200 engagements over the course of those 25 years, all sorts of companies from startups to turnarounds and everything in between. I've had a chance to work in about 70 different industries and, really, really fortunate. And then a little over 10 years ago, I got introduced to this young fella who had just started a group called Turning Point USA. And got introduced to Charlie Kirk by somebody who had gotten to know him. And we had a dinner together where we sat for about 3 hours at a table full of people. But it was like it was just the two of us at the table. And we had a connection, not just in terms of how we thought, but really in terms of it seems how we process data. And it was through that good fortune of meeting Charlie that he let me get involved with Turning Point in the early days and wrote much of their early campus literature. He and I wrote his first book together, Time for a Turning Point, and used to train their campus activists in persuasive communication. And so from that dinner here in the Illinois or Chicago suburbs, launched a career into the world of what I like to call ideas. And so we sit here today. I'm the vice president and associate publisher for Human Events Media Group. We have Human Events in the Post-Millennial under our tent. And so I work with a lot of really great, brilliant people. And I write books and speak and do other things. I had a chance during the pandemic to get to know Dr. Vladimir Solenko very well. We became very good friends. And I wrote his book with him. That was published in November of 2022, a few months after he passed away from cancer. And so that's sort of it. Start started a not-for-profit called Bridge Charities, which supports a program called Common Ground Campus that my dear friend and colleague Felissa Blazek and I founded. She really founded it. I came along for the ride. And we work with young people around the country in trying to promote constructive engagement and critical thinking and skepticism. So that's me. And yeah, if your audience is still awake, we can do the next question.
Well, here's why I think that this, so I sometimes use the example, Brent, when I'm talking, like I love hearing from, I mean, I'll just say like people that have done something for a long time. So maybe it's a pastor, maybe it's a businessman, maybe it's a doctor. And I love it because their perspective is often very rich. They've walked through the questions that we always have maybe as a younger, I'm a dad, I've got two kids, 17 and 14. And as a matter of fact, my wife and I just recently had read Charlie's book about colleges and, you know, we're navigating that next step with our child. Do we even want them in that atmosphere and all that kind of stuff? And so this is, So to talk to somebody that's going around and hosting these conversations, you know, we're a homeschool family. So, you know, a lot of that is based around this idea of critical thinking, not this idea, but this striving to raise kids that are skeptical and critical thinkers. But also, I really value this. And even what you're doing with this common ground conversation and dialogue, I just think you have your finger on your pulse and you're very honest about this. I mean, you consider yourself very lucky to have been in these conversations and experienced what you've experienced. But I also think you're a person that likes to share that with others. So I really see this today as me just really like learning from you. So what are you seeing? So what are some advice? I know you can't, you know, it's hard to do this on a podcast, but what are you seeing out there? Are you encouraged? Are you seeing this next generation, the millennials, because you can, there's almost two camps, right? It's, they're all entitled and snowflakes and there's no hope and they're the problem. And then you got this other side that says, nah, I don't think that there's more to the story. There's a deeper thing here. What's your take on it, Brent? What are you seeing?
Well, it's a big question, right? Yeah. So let's try to unpack it a little bit in pieces. First of all, the idea that, say a generation above one or two below it thinks that those generations are ruining the world isn't anything new. There was 19 years of age difference between my mother and father, and that meant that my dad thought that Elvis was going to ruin Western civilization and my mother thought the Beatles were. And then along comes me and I think rap and hip hop will.
There we go.
And so there's nothing new about us looking down at generations under us and being concerned about what they're doing. But within that sort of traditional bias might just lie also a grain of truth, right? And so in this case, usually what's wrong with a generation or two below us is our fault because we raised it.
Right.
So we've got to take a really good hard look in the mirror and say, what have we been doing for many generations back? And so I think in this country, we have become victims of opulence. And so that opulence has made us soft. It's made us less reliant upon others visibly. So if in the old days, which maybe I'm not even old enough to remember, but you could see the worker and you could see the farmer and you could see the people maybe that you were relying upon. Now today, there's all sorts of people you're relying upon, but you don't really see them because you're just sitting on your smartphone looking at the screen. So we're very, very comfortable. We're very, very able to be isolated. And that means we lose a bit of our humanity that forces us to positively engage with others. And I think that's what we see. And so when we go to college or high school campuses, when we're out in the field working with young people, what's the bright light? Well, the bright light is when you actually engage them one-on-one, when you take the time to ask them questions, to listen to the answers and be constructive, what you find out is that they're not lost souls at all. They're just sort of wrapped in plastic. And you have to be willing to get through that layer. And so we spend all of our time, you know, in that particular program teaching young people how to get through that layer with other young people and vice versa, so that hopefully down the road it pays off. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, and I want to, so, and then Tim, just see the way I want to phrase this next question. So once we get through, now there's an assumption there, but assuming that we can get through that first layer by taking the time. And I remember one time I was watching a documentary or something. They were asking these kiddos, like, little kids, like in elementary school, where does a tomato come from? And they said, a grocery store, right? They didn't know that it, you know, is grown on a farm or like a person. I grew up in the Midwest. I'm from South Dakota. So I drove by cornfields and I saw people farming. I lived on a farm when I was in college. So it's just interesting to hear that. And my wife and I were just talking this morning. You know, I think there is this reality that we're all trying to figure out. And I know it's used so often. You know, COVID exposed a lot of things, and certainly in the healthcare industry. Now I'm a holistic healthcare practitioner, so a lot of this wasn't a surprise or news to me because it's just my space. But I know for a lot of people that really lost trust in their government, they lost trust in the health agencies, they lost trust in medicine, on these types of things, which personally I think they had every ground to be very concerned about. I've been concerned about it for a long time. I think people just woke up to it. And like you said, we can't deny it anymore, right? Things are in our face that we have to see. And it does force us to deal with some things that for maybe many years or even decades, we just didn't. You use the word and you talk about this word. And I want to hear you explain it to us, because I do think it is where we need to live for a season, which the word is dissident, right? Being a dissident, or what does that word mean, and why do you encourage that behavior? Because I feel like I'm trying to raise dissidents in my house. I'm like, to my kids, right? I feel like these are these conversations we have on a regular basis, which is getting them prepared to operate in a world that we're currently in. So do you mind giving us your kind of take on that?
Yeah, I think that to sort of do it a bit metaphorically and to use a little contrast, one of the things that a good way to understand being a dissident is to compare it to being a revolutionary. And, you know, a revolutionary is trying to tear down an existing system and mm-hmm. almost stepping outside of it and trying to pull it apart. Whereas a dissident is somebody who is inside that system, who's pushing at the walls of it until it can no longer bear its own weight. Mm. And so being a good dissident means not trying to be a revolutionary who's violently trying to tear things down, but somebody who's working within the system patiently and methodically, placing themselves at risk, because as the system crumbles, by the way, it'll land on you potentially, but who's working inside the system to push out against it and try to make it collapse that way. And so good dissidents use the tools at their disposal to push back against things like, well, I think one of the simplest, greatest examples of dissidency in American history are the sit-ins at the Woolworth lunch counters in the South in the 50s and 60s. So these were people that were saying, all right, so here's a rule, and we are going to peacefully sit down on a lunch counter, and we're going to insist on being served regardless of the color of our skin. And now we're going to watch your own system try to deal with that, right? So as opposed to simply, you know, what could have been violent riots and attacks on the Washington Capitol and so on by Black people demanding civil rights. So being a good dissident means to recognize that you're going to have to put yourself at some level of risk, but you're going to have to be willing to push, and you're going to have to be willing to sustain the push.
It makes me think about you, in just using some stats that I see. You know, originally when the COVID jab came out, you know, they were trying to get everybody to take it. Now the latest numbers I hear about, like the ninth booster, I think we're on, uptake of people getting that ninth booster is under 10%. I've seen some numbers as low as 5%. And I think now that's been a lot that's created people to wake up to that reality, to say maybe that's not what they're interested in, or the masking that went on early on. This isn't a COVID conversation, but to your point, a lot of this was only allowed to happen because we participated in it. We handed over some of those rights or autonomy or whatever word that we want to use. But you do a great job. If there's anything you want to add to that, feel free. But you are also, I think, brilliant at helping us understand things that we can actually do. I think many times we feel like, you know, who am I? You know, I'm just this so-and-so. You're very, humble about some of the work that you've done and the divine appointments that you've had with Charlie and Dr. Zelenko and many others, of course. But do you have some suggestions for my listeners that are saying, you know what, I want to be a dissident? Not just, like you said, not just to be a rebel rouser, not to cause strife, not just to irritate mm-hmm. people, but for change, for productive change, for things we believe make this world a better place for ourselves and others. Can you take us through, I know you've done some writing on this, but will you take us mm-hmm. through some of your favorites and feel free to share resources, Brent, so people know how to get that.
Sure. Well, the first thing I suggest, and I don't do this to shamelessly self-promote because all the proceeds go to our foundation, but buy the book, buy Dissidently Speaking, because one of the chapters in that book is devoted entirely to the idea of why we need to become dissidents in this country now. And it has about, I lose track, I think about 18 different recommendations of different things that you can do. But let me hit a couple of conceptual highlights. You know, the first thing is, if you feel like you can't do everything, do something and do one thing. You know, you figure there's 330 million people in this country, many of them here legally, by the way. And if even half of those people woke up tomorrow morning and said, I am going to focus in on one sort of activity in which I can engage, that pushes against this totalitarian threat that we're facing. And make no mistake, we live in a country now that's facing a very real totalitarian threat. The only advantage we have, the only good news, is that it's not so far developed that we can't stop it. But the bad news is that it is very well developed and we have to act quickly to stop
it. Can I pause you there for a second? Because I don't want people to miss this point. Much like a person of faith, you know, you don't really, if you don't think if you don't think you need saving, then you're not that interested in a savior. If you don't think that what's going on is a problem, then being a dissident looks ridiculous, right? To your point. I mean, and so there, sometimes people say, oh, you know, they'll talk to me like, why do you just, you just rip on medicine or you're so anti this. And I said, listen, I understand why you would come to that conclusion, but And maybe as I get older and wiser, I'll communicate it better. But right now, there is still many that don't believe that we are in that position. And so then the response can look ridiculous, right? And again, we've learned a lot. I'm just using COVID as this backdrop, for example. You know, the people that talked about the jab 3 years ago don't talk about it the way they used to because it's been shown to be not be what we were told. And so so I want people to understand, and that's why your wisdom, and you don't say those words lightly, Brent, right? You're not throwing those words around like tyranny and what's going on here lightly. And because and if you don't know that, you got to start there, kind of know what fight we're in before the response would make any sense. Is that an accurate way of saying that?
Yeah, I think that's very well said. Well, it's like anything else. I mean, if everybody is walking outside carrying a raincoat over their arm and you think that there's absolutely no possibility it's going to rain, so you leave yours at home, well, then either it rains or it doesn't, right? And if it does rain, then you say, wow, those folks all carrying the raincoat, they were pretty smart. You're also soaking wet. And so sometimes good to take heed of a number of people who are taking precautions against something that they believe is coming. And so I think that folks that don't think this is a threat, maybe check the weather.
Oh, gotcha.
So with regard to the dissidency piece, then, if you can't do everything, do one thing. That's one element. Another element is to not behave recklessly. We don't need martyrs. We need people who stay inside of being dissidents. You know, Lech Walesa said, when he was talking about what they were able to accomplish in Poland, he said, look, when we started this, we didn't need more martyrs. He said, the fields of Poland were already watered with the blood of martyrs from the what had happened throughout the whole 20th century. He said what we needed were people that could be smart, be active, I'm paraphrasing, but basically stay in the game. And we all know the person who kind of says, watch when I'm going to post on Facebook. Mm-mm. Boy, it's going to get me banned. And they post it on Facebook and they get banned. Okay, now you're out of the fight, right? So it wasn't terribly smart to martyr yourself. So don't be reckless, be thoughtful, and understand that your actions are going to require that you sustain them. And that means by definition, they have to be sustainable. So do things that you can continue to do and push at. Sort of a final tip out of many, but just to share, is whenever possible, try to organize and act in groups. Force equals mass times acceleration. So add to the mass, and then hopefully you can impact the force. If you've got a good idea about something to do in your community to push back against some sort of totalitarian element, get others to join you. Increase the mass, and then mathematically you'll increase the force.
Brent, when these conversations you're having with the common ground, I mean, I'm just be honest with myself. Sometimes I get so frustrated talking to people that are very different. So it doesn't just happen just in the millennial group, right? This happens with adults. And you know, you hear this so much. We're so divided. We're all of these things. And I don't disagree with that statement. Do you have... because I was thinking about it as, and I've lost relationships over these last few years, and in many ways, some of those times, Brent, were because of my actions and my words and things I said that I shouldn't have said and ways I acted that I shouldn't have acted, even though I could still try to justify them, right? Because I was right, or I was this, and whatever, for whatever that means, and there's a time and a place for that, but then when it's removed. It hit me when you were saying that, you know, now you're out of the game. So, you know, whether it's family members I haven't seen now for several years because of health choices we've made or other things. Do you have some thoughts for us as, you know, as adults, as we deal with other people that are, you know, maybe on the other side of the tracks? Because we are in that time, we're in election year and all those things that are going on. And there is very real threats, very real, you know, repercussions for decisions that are made. Anything you could share with us, any wisdom there?
Well, first of all, a couple of things. Yeah. Number one, in terms of engaging others, you know, I like to make the point that I think perhaps you could argue the two most consequential humans that ever lived, one on the secular side and one on the religious side, were Socrates and Jesus Christ. Now, they had two things in common. The first is they both died for what you could call their activism. The other thing, though, that you could say is that they both changed the course of world history by asking questions. And we don't spend enough time embracing our inner Socrates or our inner Jesus. You know, there used to be those bracelets that came out of my home state of Michigan. What would Jesus do? WWJD. Well, the answer to that question actually was always the same. He'd ask a question. That's what Jesus would do. He'd ask a question. And that is the best way to engage other people. Because look, we're looking for conversions here. And the best way, first of all, no conversion sticks unless it's voluntary. And secondly, the best way to get a conversion is by having the convert convert themselves. And the best way to have that happen is by asking people questions and listening to their answers and getting them to think and getting to the point where suddenly, all of a sudden, they sort of tip their head and scratch their chin and they say, I never thought of that. Because at the moment that happens, then you have an opportunity for a conversion. So the trick with those with whom you don't agree or don't see things the way you do or where you've had conflict, if you want to resolve it, is to try to engage them with interrogatives and not declaratives. I like to say that the purpose of our book is really to flip two words in the English language and to get people to stop saying it is and start asking, is it? And if we can do that, we can change all of civilization. The other point is, And that is, you know, with regard to those, you just simply can't reach. I'm a simple man, so I get most of my lessons from television or movies or song lyrics, I suppose. When I was a kid, I loved the TV show MASH.
Yeah.
And there's a great episode, a moment in that series where Hawkeye Pierce, the superstar surgeon in the camp, had a young soldier patient die. And Hawkeye was very upset and distraught. He took it very personally that he couldn't save this patient. He was so young and he tried so hard. And the commander of the camp said, look, he was talking to Hawkeye. He said, look, son, there's two rules of medicine. He said, rule number one is that patients die. And rule number two is doctors can't change rule number one. And I think that what we have to realize is that we're not going to be able to change the minds or engage in a positive way everyone around us. We can try with everyone around us, but we can go a little Sun Tzu on it. And if we're having no success on a front, don't waste our resources there. Move to another front where we are having success and push forward.
I heard you share one time, now this was a while ago, but I thought it was valuable. It kind of struck me, honestly, when I first heard it, and you're clearly a master communicator, but when I first heard it, and ironically, I'm married to an attorney and my wife, and I remember she's a lawyer, and I remember, of course, I'm married to my wife, but she's a lawyer, I should say, and I would ask her about law school, like, what was it like? And she said, you know, it's different than any other, you know, schooling that you go through, in that it is all, at least where she went to school, it really is all based on the Socratic method. You learn how to ask questions. And she, even right. though she doesn't practice anymore, she's very grateful that she spent years kind of mastering that skill. Sometimes as a husband, I don't know if I'm glad she mastered that skill, but it helps you see the world differently, interact with the world differently. And you know, the quality of your life is based on the quality of the questions that you ask. And so I've found that to be fascinating. But you talk about this idea. And at first, the reason it struck me, because it was a little disheartening, maybe is the word. And I'm kind of just an alpha male, let's go take the hill, you know, charge.
Right.
I'm probably more reckless in some ways than I should be, based on some of the things we're talking about today. But you have stated, and I know you stand by it, that this isn't a battle that we're going to win. And this was said in the context right. of medical freedom, but I think there's a larger umbrella here. And yes. the scripture that came to mind, I want you to expound that. Scripture that came to mind for me is, and I've even thought about this as a doctor, right? Where the sick and poor will always be among you. And I always remember right. hating that scripture in a sense, right? Like, no, can't we help everybody? And not that you don't try, not that you don't give all you have to those that are in front of you, but ultimately, at least in my role, you know, one of my mentors said, you know, take no fame, take no blame, do what you can and with all that you can, but you are not the one ultimately in charge of if they will heal or not. But that statement you said where, you know, we're not going to, quote, win this. Can you expound on that and give us some perspective? Because I actually find it wildly empowering once I heard you explain it.
Sure. So I'll start with a real story from a real example. It was a Tuesday, November evening. Actually, technically, it was a Wednesday, November morning in 2016, because it was probably around 1 a.m. where I got a phone call from someone quite excited because Donald Trump had just won Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And it was all quite extraordinary. And it was clear that that he was now going to be the president. And in celebrating that, I said, look, it's true that we just blew up the Death Star. I said, but remember what the name of the next movie was. And I said, it was The Empire Strikes Back. So hold on, because let's see what's coming. And of course, and sorry about the dog in the background, perils of interviewing from home. But no one could have really anticipated what we saw coming from the totalitarian elements in this country between 2016 and 2020. In terms of the pushback against the Trump presidency, and this whole notion of American sovereignty and America first, right? But the point is that just because, you know, an election was won in November of 2016. It's not like those folks that have that totalitarian notion were going to say, oh, okay, well, I guess we lost.
Go home.
Time to go learn macrame or something. No, what they did is they went back and they said, all right, now what do we do? And what people have to understand is that almost everywhere on this globe, since the early dawn of man, for over 3,000 years, in most places, the few have subjugated the many. That means a couple things. First one is, it must be something that happens all the time, so it's not going to go away. And so you can't ever beat it. You can only hold it at bay. You can only push it back. You can win in the moment, perhaps, but there's no long-term victory to be celebrated because those forces will always be coming towards you. Also, another thing that's scary to contemplate is that if most of mankind's existence has been lived by the few subjugating the many, then what does that say about our nature to be free? I argue in the book, I think it's hard to make an argument that it's man's nature to be free. I think it is man's natural desire to want to be free, but not necessarily to be free. Because if that were the case, the many would have beaten the few over all these centuries everywhere in the globe.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? It means that our founding fathers and what they put together for us was even more miraculous than they get credit for. It wasn't a system that embraced our great free nature and spirit. It was a system that fought against our nature to perhaps not be free. That makes it a more than a grand idea.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I don't know what's your take on this. You know, we've grown up, and I think opulent, or you hear the word prosperous sometimes. You know, we've been a prosperous nation in certain measurements of that, certainly economically and things like that. Now that's maybe changing, but you've heard the saying, you probably used it, and I butcher it every time. And my wife, you know, hard times make strong men. That circle, you know, and that type of thing. And it does seem like we're in that time where. We zoned out on cell phones and we laid around some of the things you were talking about earlier here. We disengaged with our neighbor. I mean, as a business owner, I'm always amazed when I go out to maybe dinner with my wife or my family's out and you go to a store and, you know, you have five interactions with people and none of them could look at you in the eyes, shake your hand. Do math, you know, give you change. And you just sometimes wonder like what has happened. And it is concerning at times, but I think at the same time, at the risk of just sounding too Pollyanna, it's quite an opportunity. Right. And, I do believe that it matters. I believe showing up matters. I believe that the work you do matters. The work that, you know, Charlie or Dr. Zelenko, or, I mean, using him as an example, right? The legacy of his bravery, number one, but even of his work, I think has in some ways changed the trajectory of certain things. And you talked about when we do make those meaningful battles and wins, and then we need to hold that ground. And the reason I thought that was so much wisdom, Brent, was because it keeps that urgency that we can never let our guard down, not in this way that we have to live under this constant fear, but just, it's really just maturity. It's understanding where we are at and that we need to keep, you know, it's like a relationship with our spouses. You don't just get married and then say to heck with it. You know, some of the best advice you always hear is keep dating your wife as an example, right? Because that's how you can maintain the things that made it a great relationship to start with are the things that will continue to make it that. So as we kind of, you know, wind down the show, Brent, I want you to, of course, have last word. I want people to know how to stay. You do so many different things. You have your hands and influence in a lot of areas. So I want them to know how to best follow you and stay, you know, up to date with your work and reach out and read your book. So I want you to share that. But I also maybe, where are we heading? You know, it's 2024, election year. Are you optimistic? I remember hearing you talk about optimism and pessimism and that kind of exchange. Maybe that's a good way to end the show, giving us perspective on those words. But just kind of where give us some wisdom here as we wind down. Some more wisdom.
Right. So first of all, with regard to optimism, I think the Catholic Church got it wrong when they made pride one of the seven deadly sins, and optimism should be there in its place. And because optimism is nothing more than sort of a blind disregard for reality. Mm. So you can be hopeful and you can be positive, but optimistic means you're setting aside anything that might be in front of you realistically and choosing to believe otherwise. So with regard to the year we're in, the election year we're in, elections matter, of course. Obviously, they're consequential. But if you happen to be a Republican and let's say you sweep things in November and gain the White House, the House and the Senate by only a couple of votes, by the way, but let's say you do, then I would suggest you use a football metaphor. Instead of doing a touchdown dance in the end zone, I would suggest you hand the ball to the referee and realize there's more of the game to play. It was only in 2016 that Donald Trump won and the Republicans had the House and Senate. And look where we are now. Right. People overestimate the importance of elections. It doesn't mean they don't matter. It means they overestimate the importance. And they don't realize we're in a much longer game and it has a lot more to do than national politics. That's just easy and fun to focus on. Mm. But there's a lot more at work here, and it's systemic and it's national. We've gotten into this spot with over 100 plus years of negligence of this opportunity for freedom we were given. We're not going to flip it in November of 2024. Mm-hmm. So I am not optimistic about anything. I'm not pessimistic either. It's just as destructive. But realistically, we have a lot of work to do to alter the trajectory of the country. My biggest warning to your audience is please, please, please don't believe that we live in a world of cycles and pendulums. We don't. Mm. That's nonsense. It's provably false. Mm. We live in a world of cause and effect, in a world of trajectory. So imagine a missile's path and take a look at where this missile in this country is heading in terms of our future. So do everything you can to pull back and try to alter the trajectory of that missile so it misses the target, which is the United States Constitution. Mm. And let's see what we can rebuild. Finally, you're kind to ask, you know, if somebody wants to follow me, I don't know, they can go to the gym with me later, but no, don't really hang around on social media. But I can urge people to, I'd love it if you bought a copy of the book. I'd love it if you shared your thoughts. You can go to dissonantlyspeaking.com and it links through to buying the book. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and digital, and it'll be available in audiobook soon. All of the proceeds go to Bridge Charities to support our work in trying to teach young people how to find their voice and positively engage with one another, because we're trying to work at youth who have something I don't have at my age. They have a future. I've got a past, and what time is it, right? So go to bridgecharity.com and take a look at our work, commongroundcampus.com, and buy a copy of Dissidently Speaking. And the cover of the book is so brilliantly designed by my colleague that I tell her it's going to be the first book that ever sells a million copies that nobody's going to read. They're just going to put it on their coffee table for art. But Felicity did a great job on the cover.
Well, Brent, it has been an honor to have you on the show. And I don't mean this because you're older than me or anything like that. I just think it's so important that we have people like you in these conversations helping steward us and just speak into us with perspective so we can take all this, what oftentimes just seems like frenetic energy and what do? And run around like with our hair on fire and with good intentions most of the time, but just so scattered that we don't know what to do. Matter of fact, you brought up the civil rights in the past, and the numbers that I've heard is that at the time, I believe there was 20 million African-Americans in the United States, if I'm remembering this right, but less than 10% of them actually engaged actively in resistance. Mm-hmm. And so you go, well, that's surprising, first of all, but also, gosh, they made quite a difference. And I think one of their beautiful, brilliant things that they did was what you kind of talked about earlier, like getting together kind of in mass or in groups and really focusing that. So we do have limited resources in the sense of people that are trying to, you know, push this resistance and dissident behavior and doing that ethically and you know, righteously. My point in saying this is we need to join and support those groups that are doing good work. All right. You don't have to. Now, if God calls you to reinvent the wheel and create your own group, that is amazing. That is awesome. I would never talk against that. But also show up to these places where there is momentum, where it's already happening. If there already is a medical freedom group in your state or your area, or there's a bill that you need to go show up for, or something that's going on. And I just want to encourage people, because it can seem so overwhelming, but reality is, in history, when these big changes have happened or we've helped that missile, you know, miss its target, it oftentimes, probably almost all the time, it's actually a small group of people, small-ish group of people. It's never the majority.
That's absolutely right. I go into that at length in the book and why it is that it's something actually that our founding fathers missed, and Madison missed it. And I talk about that. Closing thought, all these things and making change, because I know that you do have a faith-based audience. And one of the things I hear a lot from people is that, you know, this, we have to turn this over, you know, to God, and we have to trust that God is going to prevail and so on. And so, there's nothing wrong with that sentiment, nothing wrong with it at all. But then the question is, okay, if God is going to prevail, exactly how will that work? And here's what I would suggest to people, that humans, unlike any other species, have been given four great gifts by God. The capacity, they've been given reason, conscience, free will, and the capacity for faith. So what would it possibly be that a person of faith is waiting around for God to do? I would suggest he already did it, and he did it within them. And so it is now their time to act, not to wait. Mm. So sitting back and praying for strength is fine. Mm. Praying for action, not necessarily a good idea, because in my mind, perhaps God already took that action. Mm. And he took it for you at your inception. Mm. So use the gifts that God gave you, and figure that's how he plans to intervene through you, using the tools already provided to us that no other creature on earth has.
Thank you for your time, my friend, for your brilliant work, and for your book. I hope all the listeners will go on and purchase that book so we can continue to have people just learn these important principles and support this work. Thank you for your time, my friend. Take care. God bless.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Designed to Heal. Always remember that the greatest doctor lives inside of you, and God gave you what you need to be healthy and well. Connect with Dr. Ben at drbenrawl.com or achievewellness.clinic. And please share this podcast with someone who needs to hear it, and follow us on Instagram at Designed to Heal Podcast.